During Lent, I've been preaching on the way we struggle with God. Some of the ways that we wrestle with who we are in relationship to God. And today, I scheduled to preach on wrestling with the will of God, trying to understand God's will in our lives. And I wish I hadn't planned to do that, because there is so much that needs to be said, and so many challenges for us as we try to understand God's will, that it's beyond me and takes far longer than I have today to speak it. But we come to this Holy Week, this week in which, above all weeks, Jesus chose to follow the will of God despite the cost. So let us struggle with what it means to speak of the will of God in our lives. And I begin with the 26th chapter of Matthew, during the last week of Jesus' life, during the last day before he was crucified. The 26th chapter, beginning with the 36th and continuing through the 46th verses, Jesus is on the slopes of the Mount of Olives in the garden called Gethsemane. Gethsemane means olive press. So he's in a garden of olive trees with a press nearby to press the olives into oil. This is after what we have come to call the Last Supper. Jesus has had a final meal with his closest friends. His betrayal is already in the works. Very soon, the temple guards will come to arrest him and carry him to his fate. Then Jesus went with them, the disciples, to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, "I'm deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me." And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not stay awake with me for 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again he went away for the second time and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." Again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words. And then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up. Let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." One of my avocations is military history, which I know some people find hard to believe, but it's true. And especially, I like to read the biographies and autobiographies of generals. I have found over the years that some of the most helpful guidance for me as pastor of a church is to see the challenges of military generals as they have tried to see the big picture in the midst of the fog of war, as they have tried to communicate their commands and their wishes to their staff, as they've tried to motivate their armies, as they've tried to deal with the confusion that inevitably comes in war. I happened to find this last week a book entitled Rebel Yell, a rather unlikely title, about the life of Stonewall Jackson. Now, I'm fully aware that most of you are Yankees. And so maybe you're not familiar with Stonewall Jackson. But for those few of us here born in the South, I, for example, went to Jeb Stuart Junior I went to Jefferson Davis Junior High School in Jacksonville, went to General Nathan Bedford Forrest Senior High School, and when they built a new building for it, the old one became Jeb Stuart Junior High School. So there. although my dad is from Massachusetts, and so I get to claim whichever side won. Stonewall Jackson was a fascinating man, an eccentric, a failed physics professor, a hero of the Mexican-American War, and one of the pantheon of Confederate heroes. His image is engraved on the wall of Stone Mountain in Georgia, along with Lee and Jefferson Davis, one of the great generals that America ever produced. In fact, one of the great tragic ironies of American history is that some of the very greatest military minds we ever produced fought to destroy the Union. A reminder that we must be very careful what causes we espouse, what purpose we follow. Stonewall Jackson, as a young man, had a loving wife and wanted to have a family, and so it was incredibly tragic for him when his young wife died in childbirth and he lost both his wife and his child. And the only thing that pulled him through that was his belief that her death and the death of their baby was the will of God. In both the Mexican-American War and in the Civil War, it was reported by all who knew him that he was absolutely without fear. He stood under Chapultepec Castle in the Mexican-American War, single-handedly directing his battery of artillery against the vastly superior Mexican forces, standing there in front of their cannon and muskets as if nothing was happening around him. And he did the same thing in the Civil War, riding his horse, striding before his men, totally oblivious to musket balls. One of them took off his finger. They perforated his coat. He never paid any attention. Because, as a staunch Calvinist deacon in his Presbyterian church, he believed that God had ordained when he would die, and it would not happen until God said for him to die. So Stonewall Jackson is a great example of one way that Christians can understand the will of God, that God ordains everything that happens, be it good, be it good, bad, and that we simply submit to the will of God. And that's in keeping with the fact that human beings need to find meaning in life. Life is so chaotic, so often full of what appears to be senseless violence and accident, suffering and death, that we have to find meaning. And so Stonewall Jackson is a great example of one way of approaching the will of God. It's not my way. And I would like to encourage that it not be your way, because it's not the only way of understanding the will of God. I too often have heard families say, oh, it was a tragic accident, she died too young, but it was God's will. And to me, it says that God micromanages our lives. God does not give us the ability to make decisions about whether or not we wear seatbelts, about how we live our lives, what cause we choose to fight for. And it makes of God a killer. Oh, but it was all to help us learn lessons and be better people. Yes, but still that brings to us the image of a God who kills in order to do good. And that's not the picture of God I have. Rather, God wills good for all. Leslie Weatherhead was a pastor in England during the Blitz, during World War II. He saw the incredible horror of that war, how many innocents suffered, how many lives were destroyed. And he wrote a very small book entitled The Will of God. And it still, to me, is the best book to try to understand what is God trying to do and how can I live with the will of God. And simply, he says that when every baby's born, when each of us begin this life, God has an ideal will for what we should be, that we would ideally be surrounded by a family that loves us and supports us and helps us to grow, that we have all the resources in the world to bring all of the potential in that baby into the fullest possible life, and that all will be beautiful. But that's not the way reality goes, is it? We all quickly run into the realities of imperfect parents, of bad influences, of accident, of struggle. And so in the interim, we have to deal with the will of God for us in less than perfect circumstances, when our dreams and the things we work for go wrong. What is it God wants for us in the meantime? You know, it's like you're setting out to drive to grandma's house, and then a tire blows out on the interstate. Well, your desire then is for AAA to arrive and replace the tire so you continue on your way. You didn't start out hoping that you'd be on the side of the road waiting for AAA. But once that accident happens, the answer to your prayers is that someone comes along and fixes it. And so it is in our lives. None of us live ideally, but we want to believe that God is working in the circumstances, the circumstantial will of God. Some of us never make it to grandma's house. Sometimes grandma isn't there when we get there, and sometimes we don't ever make it. But the ultimate will of God, Weatherhead says, is in the end, ultimately, and it may not even be in this lifetime, but ultimately, God's will is done, and good is done for all. The analogy he uses is rain that falls on the mountain. And those drops of water are meant to go to the sea. But many things can happen to that water, absorbed into the ground, dammed up, diverted by landslide. Those drops of water never take a straight path to the sea. But even if they sink into the earth, ultimately, the water hits a hard surface of rock and comes out as a spring, perhaps hundreds of years after it first fell, it emerges as a spring, and a new stream begins and continues its way to the sea. And ultimately, nothing can keep that water from reaching the sea. Ultimately, nothing can stop the will of God. But in the circumstances, yes, but not ultimately. Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. To me, the amazing thing about this story emerges only as I've been there, and I've taken many of you to the Holy Land with me, and another group is going with me in May. But if you understand the setting, you can understand the power of Jesus' prayer. The Mount of Olives is a ridge that faces Mount Moriah, on which the Temple Mount is placed. From the Mount of Olives, and on the slopes of the Mount of Olives, is the Garden of Gethsemane. You can descend into the Kidron Valley and then back up along a path under the walls of the temple, and beside it, the Roman fortress of Antonia. On Palm Sunday, Jesus rides a donkey down a path diagonally down the Mount of Olives into the Kidron Valley and then back up. Why is he riding a donkey? He walked for 100 miles to get there, and now he's riding a donkey. Why? Because in the Old Testament, the symbol of the Messiah, the new king of Israel, was that he was riding a donkey and the foal of a donkey. And so to consciously quit walking after 100 miles and ride the last half mile was a way of saying, I am the fulfillment of prophecy. I am the Messiah. And the disciples and all the crowd start waving palm branches. And it's not that they had suddenly turned against trees. And it's not because they were hot and needed a breeze. It's because the palm branch was the national emblem or flag of an independent Israel, waving it in the faces of those Roman officers observing from the Antonia fortress. We are independent. This is our flag of rebellion against Rome. And this is our Messiah riding on the donkey. And so this is a great theater in which Jesus rides in front of all of the people on the Temple Mount and all the Roman soldiers. The whole city of Jerusalem is looking at this as he rides in on Palm Sunday. And Jesus is signing his own death warrant by doing this. He had been up in Galilee where it was relatively peaceful, relatively safe. All he had to do there was to slip across the Jordan River to get out of King Herod's territory. And he was a long ways from the Roman legions, a long ways from the temple guards. He was doing most of his ministry and teaching in Galilee, and it was going well. But he sets his face to Jerusalem. He goes to Jerusalem, where all of his enemies are focused. He goes to Jerusalem knowing that all the prophets die in Jerusalem. He goes to Jerusalem knowing he doesn't have to be a prophet of the Son of God to figure it out. It was obvious to everybody that if he went to Jerusalem, he was probably going to die. And so that Thursday, after that final meal with his disciples, they go out to the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Eden, Garden of Gethsemane. The Garden of Eden had been corrupted long ago by the way people betray and fall asleep when they should be watchful. And Jesus prays, saying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not what I want, but what you want." Jesus is praying that God find another way. Jesus is praying that there's another way to do the ultimate will of God. And often when we pray, and it's a very legitimate thing because it's what we see throughout the Bible, we're trying to change God's mind. You know, we sometimes think that God's got this thing in his mind and God's not going to change his mind. But the Bible's actually full of instances where people argue with God, bargain with God, work with God, and God changes God's mind. Our prayers would be a lot shorter if we didn't think that. And Jesus is saying, "Please, God, I don't want to go through this. It's going to hurt. I'm going to die. I don't want that. But if it's the only way, I'll do it." And for an hour, Jesus prays this, and all the time his disciples are falling asleep. What's striking to me is when you've been there, you realize that the Garden of Gethsemane on the slopes of the Mount of Olives is like 100 yards from the crest of the Mount of Olives. When the disciples fell asleep, all Jesus had to do was get up from praying, walk 100 yards, and disappear into the wilderness of Judea. If he had crested that hill, he would have been in the wilderness, gullies, ravines, bandits, wolves, no roads, no track. He could have disappeared. And the temple guards and the Roman soldiers would never have found him. While he was praying that he didn't want to die, all he had to do was stand up and walk away. And he could have lived to a ripe old age. But he stayed there, saying, "God, I don't want this to be your will, but if it is, I'll do it." When tragedy occurs in our lives, we want to find meaning. One way of doing it is to say, "Well, it was God's will that such and such terrible thing happened." I prefer to say it this way: a terrible, senseless, meaningless thing has happened, and God cries with me in its happening. But I will work with God to create meaning in a meaningless situation. I will see to it that the organs of my loved one are donated to one who might not live without them. I will work to establish scholarships, new laws. I will find a way to make the world better out of this tragedy. I will create meaning in a meaningless situation. And for me, that is God's will being worked out. And yes, when someone dies, yes, God reunites them. God makes them ultimately whole. God brings them home. I don't think God says, it's time for you to come home. What? But in the tragedy of one's loss and death, God, whose heart is broken along with ours, reaches down and says, I can do what you cannot do. I can make them whole. I can bring them home. There's a big difference between saying, well, it's your time, and saying, oh, your time came, I'm so sorry, but let me help. Let me help. Well, you can understand the will of God, I can understand the will of God, and God knows who's right. All I know on this Palm Sunday is that Jesus did not want the will of God to be that he was going to have to die, but he'd seen that coming ever since the time of the wilderness, ever since the temptation to take the easy way out. He knew that the hard way was the one that was going to have to be. And so he was willing to do the will of God, even though it was incredibly difficult. May you and I wrestle with the will of God, and may God's will ultimately be done. Pray with me. Oh God, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. May we come to understand your will a bit better. May we work with you. May we see not judgment, not a capricious or murderous God, but a loving, caring God who in the end brings us meaning. Amen. Let's stand to sing our closing hymn.